This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Alan Spears, Cultural Resources Director, and Rob Smith, Northwest Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. Alan and Rob are here to tell us about the challenges faced by national parks and steps being taken to protect America's national park system for present and future generations. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about the National Parks Conservation Association?
We are a 501c3 membership-driven organization, and we were founded in 1919 by Stephen Mather, the first director of the National Park Service, who understood even at that early period that national parks were going to need a citizen watchdog, workdog group to protect them from all kinds of scheming that happens, political, planning, otherwise. And so we've been involved in that kind of advocacy since 1919, and we serve as the leading voice of the American people on behalf of the national parks.
Before we go into detail about individual issues, would you give a brief overview of the key challenges faced by our national parks?
There are a number of challenges right now, and it's everything from funding to assaults on some of the key provisions and laws and policies that help to keep our national parks protected. So we're looking right now, especially at a number of executive orders that are coming out of the Trump administration that reverse some of the protections that we have on oil and gas drilling and exploration in our national parks. We're also looking at a budget for FY 2018 that will cause substantial reductions if passed. The president's recommended budget will cause substantial reductions in staffing and then the ability of the Park Service to deliver programming on behalf of the public and to protect the natural, cultural, and historic resources that are in their charge. So there are a number of things that we're looking out for right now.
When I first took this job years ago in the conservation movement, I assumed that national parks were protected and we didn't need to pay any attention to them. It was really the other lands, the forests and the big grazing landscapes and wide open spaces. Very soon in the first few weeks came to learn that national parks are threatened by a lot of stuff, not only internally, but especially externally. Air pollution, for instance, dams that block streams for fish passage. So national parks need to be constantly renewed as protected areas, and that's why the importance of NPCA remains, and especially now in these times.
How are our national parks funded?
Well, they are primarily funded through tax dollars, that is, collectively by all of us. They're not adequately funded that way. There are opportunities for private donations in a limited way, but there's a reason why there's a $12 billion backlog with a B, because the parks have been starved for funding from Congress that has chosen not to fund adequately the operations. There are fewer rangers than there used to be some years ago. So it's really a public responsibility, much as any other public good like libraries and highways and airports and things like that. It's something we all benefit from. So there are opportunities from private investment, but that's pretty limited.
You've started alluding to this, but what does the national park funding support?
Funding for national parks supports everything from the rangers you see, or in some cases don't see anymore when you drive in, naturalists that guide you on the trail, greet school kids, researchers that take care of, say, salmon in the Elwha River or grizzly recovery in the North Cascades or monitor air pollution in power plants next to parks, those sorts of things, as well as just the maps you get from national parks. When you visit it on your own, you know why they're important and what you can see. So all kinds of things like that. Some you see, some you don't.
What is the current status of funding for our national parks?
Inadequate. I would say chronically inadequate. The parks are still open, at least barring government shutdown, but you'll see fewer rangers than we used to, say, a decade ago. There are actually fewer positions there. And now currently there's a hiring freeze for many positions, so some parks that have openings aren't able to fill them. We've heard reference to the backlog. There are old water systems underneath some of the visitor centers that need to be replaced instead of just bandaging them together with duct tape and preventing leaks. There are some trails that need to be repaired so that people can use them better, including accessible trails, for instance, in campgrounds. There's research that needs to be done to make sure that fish recovery is really happening, that wildlife is really protected. And there also is support for programs such as air pollution, protecting the natural quiet of national parks. Those take people to do that, and there aren't quite enough people to do it, and the facilities have gotten old, and they need to be repaired.
Could you give us a sense in terms of dollars of how deficient the funding is?
Nationally, the Park Service calculates $12 billion of needed repairs. About half of that is roads, so potholes, roads that wash out, the old bridges, those kinds of things. You can kind of put off some of that, but each year you put it off, it becomes more expensive to fix when you finally get to it. Those are the kind of things we need to make progress on and reverse the trend. The other half of the backlog is really things that visitors use. Trails, visitor centers, maybe they've gotten old, as well as the rangers that go in them. So those are the kind of things that need to be done. The parks are still open. They're still great places. They still have rangers. They're just not what they were or could be with just adequate funding.
And compared to the past, what does the funding look like today? Was it much better in the past?
I don't think there's ever been a golden age, but certainly, for instance, in the 50s and 60s, there was Mission 66 marking the 50-year anniversary of the Park Service. And the goal was in 1966, the parks would have come out of a 10-year investment in a lot of new facilities to greet the crowds that were coming post-World War II in record numbers, families, people from all around saying, let's get out and see our national parks. We're sort of in a similar situation now where we're seeing record visitation, but we're seeing proportionally a decline in actual dollars as well as buying power of those dollars. So as the parks are getting more visited and more used, there are fewer people and fewer resources to take care of them. So it's time for a reinvestment, which is what we're supporting at the congressional level.
What is the status of deferred maintenance in Washington State National Parks?
About $500 million of that $12 billion is Washington State, and there are 15 different national park units, ranging from really big places like Mount Rainier and the Olympics to very small places like Klondike Gold Rush and downtown Pioneer Square. A couple of the small places don't need very much, but some of the larger parks with a lot of roads and a lot of visitors, Olympic is the most visited park in the Northwest. That itself needs almost $200 to $300 million of that, just because there's a lot of road repair, a lot of facilities, and a lot of visitors that come and use it.
What is being done to provide more adequate funding for the national parks?
Well, the previous Congress was able to pass the Centennial Legislation, and the legislation would establish an endowment for the national parks, looks to get some dedicated funding to help increase funding for park operations. And we are working with our allies and champions in Congress right now to get the best budget we can for FY 2017, and then again for FY 2018, which will come in another month or so. But in addition to the maintenance backlog that Rob's talked about, there's also an operating deficit, an annual operating deficit that the national parks face, and I think that's in excess of $600 million a year. And what happens is that when you have parks not getting all the money that they need, it impacts their ability to deliver programs. You have to close visitor centers or restrooms. You don't have the ranger-led programs or hikes or talks. And it really has an adverse impact on visitor experience. And so that's one of the reasons why we're looking to get a plus up for the National Park Service budget, which at this point in time is still only 1/14 of 1% of the overall federal budget. So we're not talking about a large amount of money. And we would like to shift the paradigm, the way people think about this, because we've got critics out there who think about expenses for national parks as being a luxury, something that we can't afford. But parks last year generated, I think, $34 billion in economic activity for the country. And so if we kind of flip the switch on the way people are thinking about national parks, think about them as an investment, something that's a long-term investment and a commitment that we've made for now over 100 years, that the funding then should follow that and set that as a priority for the country. And we can see national parks helping to generate economic activity in communities all across the United States.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Alan Spears, Cultural Resources Director, and Rob Smith, Northwest Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. Our topic is the challenges faced by national parks and steps being taken to protect the park system for present and future generations. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What steps has the new administration taken so far that will impact our national parks?
We're still waiting to see what those will finally be. In part, that's because the new administration still has a lot of appointees that make decisions, jobs to fill, and we haven't seen who those people are. For instance, there's no permanent director to the National Park Service, and a number of undersecretaries who would have some influence on that. So to some degree, we're in a holding pattern. Some of the early signs are very mixed. Certainly the new Interior Secretary Zinke has said, I support retaining national parks. We're not going to sell them off in public lands. I support funding of the Land and Water Conservation Fund to acquire additional park lands within the national parks so we don't have problematic private inholdings there. And I support funding the national parks. But we've also seen the first budget from the White House include a 12% projected cut in Interior Department funding that would trickle down to the national parks. So we're now seeing an executive order that says we're calling into question large national monuments that have been done by the last few presidents. Some of those have been national park areas. So very mixed signals as to what the future would be, and I'd say a lot of unknowns. So what people can do right now is to speak up for national parks, among other things that they value. It really is America's common ground. People agree that the national parks are one of the best things this country has done, and it serves everybody. We need to put the money there, and we need to add our voices there.
Would you say more about the Antiquities Act that you referred to and the significance for reviewing the new monuments that have been put into place over the last 20 years or so?
The Antiquities Act goes back to 1906, and it was the power that Congress gave to the president to save places that we already own and might be threatened by destruction. It's actually an extremely conservative act in that it was a way of keeping things the same on public lands we already own. Many of those national monuments which are created that way that the president has created, and almost every president, 8 Republicans, 8 Democrats, have used that one to some degree or another, save everything from very small places, Native American sites, cultural sites. Sometimes there are underwater lands like marine reserves. Olympic National Park began as a national monument created by President Teddy Roosevelt, and it was ultimately ratified and expanded by Congress later on. So it's a way of buying some time to save some places until Congress chooses to act, because sometimes Congress takes longer to act than you'd like it to. And the president has the ability to step in and say, okay, we're going to save an option for the future here. We've almost always looked back on those and said, these are the building blocks in much degree, our national park system. These are great ideas, and we celebrate them now, even though at the time there might have been some controversy. So the controversy we read about in the papers today and tomorrow about national monuments is really more about politics than protecting things.
I think that's right. And, you know, the Antiquities Act has been used to establish such controversial sites as the Grand Canyon. And I think back in the day, there was a real fight to keep the federal government from establishing any kind of ownership over the Grand Canyon. And now it's a World Heritage Site. It draws 4 million tourists every year and is the largest, I think, economic generator in that area. So we see that sometimes the criticism that faces national monument designations doesn't stand the test of time, but the parks do. And I think what we're looking at is national parks are falling victim to a larger fight, an ideological fight in Washington about ownership, federal land, the federal footprint in individual states and places like Utah. And there's an old proverb that says, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. And in this particular instance, the national parks are the grass, because we've got an ideological conflict between more ownership, less ownership, and what's lost in that sometimes are the benefits that accrue to communities and the preservation of cultural resources in perpetuity for the benefit of future generations. And that's stuff that I think we want to stand behind, and that's a commitment that we want to extend. But there's some people who I think are looking at more short-term political gains, and we are working with them right now as best we can to defend national parks and to defend the Antiquities Act. It's been a law that's worked well for this country. As Rob said, it's got strong bipartisan support. It was used first by a Republican president. It was used very well and very judiciously by President Obama. And it would be worth noting that one of the criticisms of the Antiquities Act is that these are sort of federal overreach parks that are established by people in Washington, D.C., when in fact they're always community-driven. And the Obama administration went through great lengths, great pains to make sure that there was 110% buy-in for all of the national monuments that they designated.
What actions have been taken or are being considered by the current Congress that will impact the national parks?
We've got a good one in the National Park Service Legacy Act, S-751, for those of you who are legislation geeks like I am. And the idea behind the National Park Service Legacy Act is it's a deferred maintenance bill. and it would provide a dedicated stream of funding to help pay down the National Park Service deferred maintenance backlog. We've got what passes in Washington, D.C. these days for strong bipartisan support, at least initially, with Senator Portman, a Republican from Ohio, and Senator Warner from Virginia as the original co-sponsors. And we're going to be working that bill to see if we can't move it through the legislative process to establish a dedicated stream of funding that would knock down the maintenance backlog.
What is being done to enhance cultural diversity in our national parks?
Great question. Well, you know, we had just talked about the Antiquities Act designations, and I don't want to be looking always into the past, but one of the things that's happened recently is the use of the Antiquities Act to establish a number of new national parks that really help to increase park system diversity. And we were able to work with the previous administration to establish or designate Stonewall Inn in Lower Manhattan, the first national park unit that exclusively commemorates the history of the LGBTQ community and the uprising that took place at Stonewall in 1969. I happened to help work on a campaign to establish the Birmingham Civil Rights National Monument in Birmingham, Alabama, that commemorates a very important part of the American civil rights history. We were working on campaigns to establish the Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Monument. And one of the things of interest for me is, in terms of the numbers, we've got about 417 units in our national park system right now. Out of that number, just about 10, maybe 11, were established specifically to commemorate some aspect of women's history. Now, I try never to do math in public, but that's an underrepresentation of at least 51% of the American population. So we've got to work to do more there. But it's park system diversification through the use of the Antiquities Act and establishing new park sites. The Interior Department has launched a number of studies and published at least one, Latinos in the Making of America. They will be releasing one on the Asian Pacific Islander American communities. And from those documents, we hope to draw the inspiration and guidance from which we can identify sites, themes, and resources that could be protected at the federal level. So we're working on that, and then in addition to that, working to increase the constituency for national parks. And whether we're working with veterans or youth or people from diverse communities, and by diverse I mean race and ethnicity, but also geographic location, we want, it's maybe a hackneyed phrase, but we really want a big tent in terms of those people who support national parks and who support the National Parks Conservation Association. We want everyone in there if they're able and willing to help us protect national parks.
Would you say more about what is being done to seek input from underrepresented and or underserved communities in regards to decisions about national parks?
Yeah, it's all part of the process of how the Park Service and the Department of the Interior engage with communities, whether we're talking about tribal relations or whether we're talking about racial and ethnically diverse communities. There has been, rightly or wrongly, actually or perceived, a sense in some of these communities that the Park Service imposes and that they don't listen. I don't think that's entirely accurate in my experience, but it does mean that our National Park Service personnel have to be not just resource managers, but they have to be diplomats. And they're really good at doing that in most instances. When they go out and they're able to talk to people in communities, it always begins with questions about how does this impact your community? What is it that you're looking to protect and preserve? What are the important stories? And we saw that when we were working in Birmingham. We saw that when we were working at Stonewall, that the Park Service was asking those questions of people in the community. Tell us what it is that you want to protect and preserve, and then we can help you figure out a strategy to make that happen. So that kind of engagement is empowering people so that they understand and that we are sort of removing them from the base of critics who say that the Park Service is all about the kind of top-down approach. It's actually very grassroots and very bottom-up, and that's all about that outreach and gaining input from people from the very start of the process and not at the back end.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Alan Spears, Cultural Resources Director, and Rob Smith, Northwest Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. Our topic is the challenges faced by national parks and steps being taken to protect the park system for present and future generations. Would you give an overview of the current priorities for national parks in the Northwest?
You know, we have such a variety here in Washington State. There are 15 different units, anything from a piece of the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail along the Columbia to smaller cultural and historic sites, the Bainbridge Island Japanese American Exclusion Memorial. for instance, Pioneer Squares, Klondike Gold Rush, and then, of course, you've got the ones that everyone knows, like Mount Rainier and the North Cascades and Olympics and some in between. So it's a huge variety. One of the threats facing the Olympics is the increasing presence of Navy warfare training with jets over the Olympics, raining noise down in the Olympics. The Navy has alternatives. They use them now, other places they can fly. We'd like to convince them to fly further away from the Olympics, so the Olympics retains a refuge for wildlife and people seeking the natural quiet, especially in the Ho rainforest. So we're just beginning to work with local groups there and let those voices be heard, and trying to work with the Navy on that as well. One of the opportunities, and it may be a challenge, or we would hope it would be an opportunity, would be recovering the endangered grizzly bear in the North Cascades. There are still a few left, most of them in British Columbia, but a small handful that may still exist in the North Cascades of Washington State. We do have grizzlies elsewhere in the state, the northeast of Spokane in the mountains, so it's not a stranger to this area. There used to be thousands. And this is a species that's not coming back by simply leaving it alone, unlike, say, wolves or salmon or wolverines or some of the other great iconic species. And this is, by the Park Service's estimation, the most rugged mountain range in the lower 48. So it's a glorious place, been referred to as America's Alps. It's a place that should be a legacy that we hand down to future generations with all of its components, and the grizzly bear should not be allowed to wink out on our watch. So the plan promoted by the Park Service and the state and some of the others is to bring in some extra grizzly bears from recovering or healthy populations up in British Columbia or near the Glacier Park area in Montana, and begin to augment the existing population so there are enough bears to create a sustainable, manageable population. Of course, they want to put them in the most remote places, bring in the bears that are not problem bears, and put them in the best habitat, so really to minimize any potential problems. But how exciting to have that to be able to pass on to our kids. But it's also a threat of being of winking out on our watch, and I don't think we should do that. That's not what the national parks and the surrounding landscape are about. And I think most people in Washington would say, yeah, we ought to save what we've got and pass that on. And that's really at the bottom of what national parks are about, is saving what's special and passing it on.
What is the current status of efforts to bring about grizzly bear recovery?
The status is that the government is looking at what to do, having heard at length through public meetings and public comments from people in Washington and everywhere else that have an interest in grizzly recovery in the North Cascades. Probably over the course of the next year, they will be assessing what issues have been raised and what the best course of action is. The action alternatives that they're proposing are a variety of either go slow or go fast or somewhere in between, which is an alternative we're suggesting, of bringing in grizzlies from elsewhere to add to the population that's here in hopes that they would get up to, say, 20 or 25 grizzly bears in the next decade or so. That might be enough to begin starting a population that will recover on its own. There'll be enough bears to find each other, to reproduce naturally in some of the most remote places of the North Cascades. That decision has not yet been made. That's a decision that the Trump administration and Secretary Ryan Zinke will make as to how or whether to proceed. That's one of those things we should be speaking up on.
Let's touch again on Olympic National Park and quiet. So there is an effort to make it a certified quiet park. What does that designation mean?
It's a name that draws attention to a national park's special value of this is a place you can find natural quiet, natural sounds. The Olympic National Park is one of the most ecologically, but also one of the most acoustically diverse places. When you think about it, you've got the ocean, you've got the rainforest, and then you've got also the high mountain peaks. You can hear wind, you can hear elk bugling, you can hear crashing surf. So some sounds are loud and some not so loud, but it ought to be a place where you go to hear the sounds of nature. This is especially important and particular to not only the people that live there and tourists, but also military vets recovering from a trauma of war actually are finding refuge in natural landscape, including out on the west coast of the Olympics. And to hear the sounds of, increasing sounds of Navy war jets going overhead, of course, takes them exactly in the wrong direction where they're trying to go. And it's a bother to the rest of us. A national park should sound like a natural park and not a parking lot at an airport. And that is our point. There are other places to do this training and fly these airplanes, which are among the loudest in the world and are being increasingly based in Naval Air Station, Whidbey Island. We would like to find alternative places for that training to happen, all places that the Navy is using now, but not use one of our quietest and most spectacular national parks as that location.
What do you see as the key priorities for national parks over the next few years?
Well, I think one of the things we have to continue on is the effort to enhance cultural diversity. And it's not that we want to do that because we think it's the right thing to do. It is. But as an advocacy organization, we want the largest, most well-informed and active constituency that we can manage for national parks so that we can win more often. We can win on funding. We can win on management policies. We can win and roll back efforts to abolish or rescind the Antiquities Act. And so we need to make sure that communities that are not inclined necessarily to be park lovers or park advocates simply because they've had a different background or a different experience coming up, that they understand that there's a park system that's out there, it's theirs, their tax dollars help to support it, and it's relevant to their communities. It helps to protect and preserve things, cultural, historic, and natural and scenic resources that they value. And that's one of the priorities going forward for the National Parks Conservation Association. It's also a priority for the National Park Service.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Boy, the national parks have been called one of America's best ideas. It certainly is a homegrown idea here in the United States, but we ought to put our money where our ideas are. And this is also at a time when America seems to be at odds with itself over so much. This is a place of common ground. This could be a rallying point around our national parks. We can make them better. We can add to that legacy to reflect the diversity of the country and the ongoing history we have and the great landscapes we have. But boy, this is one place that can bring us together, and it's worth investing in that, and it's worth bringing our kids and next generations and other people that aren't familiar with parks to them, because they were left to us to take care of and to appreciate. We want to be able to do that for the next generation.
And I would say that 330 million people can't be wrong. And that's how many visits we had to national parks last year. And it's not a red state thing or a blue state thing. It's an American thing. And it's our legacy and our patrimony. And we need to take care and protect these places.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Diane.
You are just listening to Alan Spears, Cultural Resources Director, and Rob Smith, Northwest Regional Director, for the National Parks Conservation Association. For more information, check on the web at npca.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.